Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why is life so boring sometimes? And is the tendency to lose interest in things a character flaw or an inevitable part of human experience? My guest today freely admits he suffers from boredom as much as the next person, if not more. But as unpleasant as it can be to find himself less than absorbed with whatever he's doing, he also believes boredom has helped the human race conceive new ideas and saved us from pastimes that might not be good for us in the long run. Peter Tuohy is professor of classics in the Department of Greek and Roman Studies at the University of Calgary. His new book is called Boredom, A Lively History. Peter, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
You remind us first thing that boredom is not a trivial emotion. We experience it throughout our lives over a lot of waking hours.
Yes, I think so. The exact statistics are not terribly easy to come by, as you could imagine. It's not the sort of thing people spend a lot of time trying to figure out. Mm-hmm. But the a rather odd one with a British survey by Triviala.com, it's a little suspect, but it's an interesting one. Estimated that something like 2 years of a lifetime that runs for 60 years, this is the waking hours, are probably spent in boredom. So that makes it a fairly significant thing to be suffering, doesn't it?
It does, and yet it's always a little embarrassing to admit that we're bored.
Yes, I know. It's dreadful, isn't it? I feel awfully embarrassed when I have to say it. And I think the reason for this is because we associate it so much with children.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't like to be feeling guilty of suffering a childish emotion. Why do we associate it with children? My guess is probably no better than anybody else's, but probably because our children so often tell us they're bored, and when we tell them to stop it, and you know, that boring people get bored, we come out with the usual cliches and so on.
Yeah, it's funny. I think everyone has a parental or grandparental sort of expression that they grew up with, basically where adults didn't want to have to deal with the problem and so sent kids off to find their own way.
Yes, I think so. Yeah, I've often felt, too, that we say these dreadful things to children. Perhaps they're not so dreadful, but and then we immediately set about trying to find something that'll stop them being bored. So instinctively, we know it's not a good situation to leave them in, but we still deny it, because I don't think we ever really walk away from our children and say, you know, you're giving me the horrors because you're bored, I'm going to leave you. Rather, we get some toys for them or take them out and so on.
You know what's so interesting about boredom, Peter? It doesn't hurt. It doesn't feel threatening. Why is it so unpleasant?
You know, it's interesting you ask that, because I've often talked to people about that, and some people feel it does hurt a little.
Mm-hmm.
And one person I spoke to reckoned they could taste it. And, you know, I thought, boy, this is a good one. And they reckon, I said, what does it taste like? And they said, it tastes like rust. There might be more logic in that than it seems, because there's a link with boredom and disgust.
Uh-huh.
And something like rust, I guess, is a disgusting sort of a taste. And we can probably associate boredom with certain types of colors, too. You know, the sort of some greens are sort of rotting, limey green.
Mm-hmm.
We might be, I don't know, but perhaps hardwired to find some sort of disgust in certain types of tastes and colors. If boredom's then associated with disgust, it might be linked with these sorts of sensations.
Well, it would make sense, you know, if it drives us to seek out variety in things even as simple as our diets. You know, we get bored eating the same food day after day, perhaps because we need different nutrients.
Yes, I think so. That whatever it is, it's not quite pain, isn't it? But it's pushing us for change.
Mm-hmm.
We've got some sort of suspicion that things aren't right if they go on in this way.
What's going on in our brains when we feel bored?
Well, you know, I've written a book about it, but I'm probably the wrong sort of person to actually ask about it. As you know, I'm a professor of classics.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a neurologist, though. I do talk to neurologists. I think it's probably too early to pin down. They're only just starting to speculate on the portions of the brain where it might occur, if it's if it's in this region called the insula and so on. So I don't think there is a clear answer for that.
Mm-hmm. Why do we yawn when we feel bored?
Well, I think yawning is supposed to be linked, is it not, with this notion of refreshing the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it is, this continuous sense of predictability and non-change makes us feel somewhat sleepy if it persists. And I think we yawn because yawning, in some manner or another, oxygenates the brain and has a tendency to wake us up.
And, of course, Jean-Paul Sartre linked boredom to nausea.
Yes, yeah, it's a persistent theme that's linked with boredom as far back as you can, well, as far back as I can go, I think. Why is it linked with nausea? I suspect because boredom of itself is a slightly disgusting experience.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I think it is disgusting is because disgust itself is a sort of an adaptive emotion, as they call it. It's designed to stop us eating things that are poisonous. Well, I think boredom perhaps works in a social sense, not in this chemical or physiological sense, to keep us clear of situations that are injurious in the same sort of way as a poisonous thing can be.
So listening to somebody droning on at a cocktail party about something that you don't care about at all maybe keeps you from meeting other people at the party that are interesting.
Yeah, it could be. It sounds a less harmful instance, doesn't it, that it's just mildly painful. But perhaps, and this is a line of speculation that some people have gone with, we're hardwired against certain types of activity. Loneliness is a good one. People talk about us being hardwired not to be lonely because, I guess, in our primeval origins, loneliness is a bad sort of characteristic for a person to have in a group setting, and these are intensely group orientated societies, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, boredom. You imagine, for example, you're an Australian Aboriginal. I think these semi-Stone Age societies, where cooperation's everything in that extraordinarily arid deserts that they that many of them, not all of them, inhabit. Cooperation is important. A bored person, a person who is switching off from the group, as boredom can make you do, is a danger to group survival. And so if this line of speculation is perhaps right, perhaps it's in our very makeup. We're hardwired against these things. So when we're at the party, we're reacting with an emotion that's been wired into us over many thousands of years.
It's interesting to me that we trivialize boredom as a form of suffering, and yet we have instinctively used it in connection with punishment for a long time. Something so simple as sending kids to time out or to their rooms or you know, in a more fundamental way, we send criminals to prison or, if they're really bad, to solitary confinement.
Yeah. It doesn't seem to me a very justifiable way to use a penal system. We can argue a lot about this sort of thing, but I think, according to the letter of the law, a punishment is a punishment, and it might be, you know, 5 years, 10 years, whatever it is. But the punishment doesn't have the value-added punishment of, and for 5 years you should be bored to tears. I don't think that's a good sort of thing, and I don't think that's fair, that is to say, unjust, that we add an additional punishment. And it perhaps is quite dangerous, too.
Well, it's certainly not a great use of the time of people we have locked up, rather than, you know, teaching them some skill or forcing them or requiring them, I should say, to work.
Mm-hmm. No, I think so. The learning of skills makes a lot more sense. And I can speak less of the U.S. Penitential system because I don't live there, and Canada's is quite different, and I know a little more perhaps about the UK one too. But the link between boredom and drug taking in prisons is one that's often made, in at least in other countries. It makes sense, doesn't it, from a intuitive point of view, so that if you could control boredom, get people to do something practical with their time, learn skills that may return them to the community as better individuals, or at least individuals more capable of coping, you might be saving them from drugs and saving people from a lot of the mayhem that does go on in prisons.
At this point in the discussion, I think it's probably important to make the distinction between different forms of boredom. Simple boredom, chronic boredom, existential boredom. Let's start with simple boredom. Which one is that?
Well, simple boredom, I guess, is the one we've been talking about mostly, isn't it? Except mm-hmm. when Sartre's name came up. But I'd define it as it's an emotion of mild disgust that it's produced by temporarily unavoidable and predictable circumstances. So if you think of think of yourself at the cocktail party you referred before, it's temporarily unavoidable because you're stuck with the person who's going on, and it'd be rude to simply tell them, you know, you're a boring creature and I'm getting out of here. And it is profoundly predictable because you know what they're going to say. So unavoidable and predictable seems to be the key things to this notion of simple boredom. And it's the boredom we all feel if you're stuck in your car on the way home, or if you're listening at a long and dreary meeting, if you're a child putting up with a day where there's not enough entertainment and so on. So that's what I'd call simple boredom, and it is what I'm mostly interested in.
Mm-hmm. And just to get the other two out of the way, chronic boredom is the tendency to feel simple boredom a lot more than typical.
Yeah, I guess I do have quite a bit to say about chronic boredom, and I think it is important, isn't it? It's a boredom that won't go away, this simple sort of a boredom, and it's usually linked, if you can trust the literature, and I have to take it on faith a little bit, but there seems to be an awful lot of it. It's linked to a lower level of dopamine within, or at least a lower ability to absorb dopamine within a human's body. So the dopamine is the neurotransmitter associated with excitement and pleasure and so on. So that some individuals, it seems, are born with a lower level than normal of dopamine, or with a lesser number of dopamine receptors, so others have said, so that they're not getting quite the kick from the normal flow of dopamine that that you might get, for example. I left myself out of that one.
So these are the folks who, to put it sort of crudely, go looking for trouble.
Yes, it seems there's a link between, if your dopamine's low, you're going to look for a jolt, mm-hmm. and the jolt is produced by risk-taking behavior. So hang gliding, black run skiing, driving your car fast, drinking too much alcohol, these sorts of risk-taking behaviors are going to give you a dopamine spike and relieve for a time the chronic boredom to which you're biologically cursed or doomed to.
And a little risk-taking, obviously, is good and important for us as a society, but too much and there's nobody left to carry on society.
Yes, you're going to reach a sticky end on a spruce tree at the bottom of the Black Run, aren't you, if you're not careful. So, yes, chronic boredom is a serious problem, and it's associated, they usually say, particularly with younger males, and it's we've all had experience with the sorts of problems they can get themselves into at that sort of an age. So that's chronic boredom. It's a serious problem, and it's one that that persists. And I don't know that they know quite how to solve that yet.
My guest is Peter Tuohy. He's professor of classics in the Department of Greek and Roman Studies at the University of Calgary. His new book is called Boredom, A Lively History. We'd love to get your take on this. You can join the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Peter Tuohy. He is professor of classics in the Department of Greek and Roman Studies at the University of Calgary. His new book is called Boredom, A Lively History. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So, Peter, this third form of boredom, known as existential boredom, is a sort of overall disinterest with the world at large and with one's place within it. What is the difference between that and, say, clinical depression?
I don't think there's a huge amount of difference, mm-hmm. really. Not the way it's peddled, as it were. I think I feel a little more charitable maybe about it since I've written the book, because people have questioned me a lot about it and suggested I'm a little unfair to it. But whatever it is, if we were to define it, it is along the lines of you saying that you've been saying. It's often said to be a powerful and unrelieved sense of emptiness, isolation, even alienation. And that could easily be depression, couldn't it? I think that it's probably its origins are religious, mm-hmm. even biblical. It's associated with the demon of noontide, a sort of not quite satanic, but an evil presence that tempts the Christian or the monk or even the pre-Christian, that is to say, it goes back to the Psalms, to despair in the beneficence of God and of the value of God's universe. So if that's its origins, then it has a pretty reasonable background, and one that is perhaps more important than simple depression, because I think we all, if we're religious, periodically feel this sense of does it all work? Does God care? Is there a purpose in human life, in the universe? Mm-hmm. So we could take it two ways. In other words, the novelists, the more recent one, is perhaps something closer to depression, but in origin, existential boredom is perhaps a religious experience.
I wonder if our dismay in our own boredom, in terms of the way it makes us appear to other people, has anything to do with that sort of Calvinist sense that no good true believer could possibly be bored with the practice of faith.
Yeah, I'm sure that it's linked to that, and I think linked to the value placed upon work at the time of the Enlightenment, mm-hmm. and so on, that somehow or other you're letting your community down, religious or human, by giving way to an emotion that so alienates you from productivity and so on. So, yes, I agree with you.
On the other hand, you dismiss the idea that boredom is a sort of luxury that was not available to our ancestors trying to live out their nasty, brutish, and short existences.
Well, you've got to go such a long way back before their existences were terribly short, don't mm-hmm. they? That you go back, say, 2,500 years. Lots of people lived to a ripe old age. That you can live into your 90s if you can get past those dangerous early years in Greece and Rome, for example. But lots of people lived into their 70s, let's say that. So I think what you're getting at is what sort of a history does this have?
Right.
And it's often suggested that boredom, whether we're dealing with simple or existential, is an invention of the last several hundred years, that earlier people didn't feel it. Well, the Romans certainly did, and there's inscriptional evidence pointing to it. They use a word, tedium or TDR in the plural, that's linked to our word tedium. It's pretty clearly boredom that they're talking about. Mm-hmm. So it's got a fair history. I imagine if you took it back further still to people like the, not the Plains Indians, but Indians before, let's say, or First Nation before the horse, Australian Aboriginals never had it, but they probably didn't get a chance for boredom, I suspect.
Mm-hmm. Things were scary all the time.
Yeah, you're too busy surviving. I think that's the thing. So certainly if you're living in arid deserts, you've got to move constantly and someone carries the fire. You've got to follow song lines, don't you? So you've got to memorize this constant, these complex patterns of movement through deserts and so on. So I think they lived extremely busy lives.
I was surprised to read that the word boredom is relatively new to the English language.
It is. It is. It's said to date back into the early 1800s. But does that worry you too much? I mean, you look at your dog, and if your dog's bored, you know, and Rover isn't real good at saying, "I'm bored." He's still bored.
And you know, sometimes there's that destructive behavior that comes along with that. They go look for your best pair of shoes if they've got nothing else going on.
That's right, yes. And I mean, you can say, I guess, if you're a total skeptic, well, of course the animal's not bored. And I'd say back, well, the animal is bored. Look at it. And they'd say, no, it's not. And I'd say, well, there's our problem. We're dealing with a creature that can't talk. He can't tell us he's bored, but nor can a small child. But yet we know when children are bored. So I think that this relates to what you're saying, doesn't it, that the word boredom itself is new to English. I don't think that proves a single thing, because if that were the case, a Frenchman couldn't be bored, could he? Because he doesn't know our English word for boredom. Hmm. He has to say something like, you know, he suffers from ennui and so on. So I don't think words matter very much, mm-hmm. because there were different words in different periods.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Tim in Richardson. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I'm wondering, this may sound odd. I haven't heard your guest mention it, but I can literally say in the last 20 years that I have never been bored.
Wait, hang on a second, Tim. Let me interrupt you. Not standing in line for your driver's license, not in a traffic jam, none of that?
I can honestly say I don't find any of that boring. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't get excited about doing things like that, but I'm never bored even doing things like that. I always find some way to make it even vaguely interesting. And I've had people tell me that perhaps there's something wrong with me because of that. I know obviously you can be. There are people who are too bored when it comes to a lot of things. But and I will say I work for myself and I make my own schedule and I do tend to be a little bit of a worrier. But literally, I have not been bored in the last 20 years, and I'm just wondering how often your guest has maybe run across that condition and if there might be some long-term problems associated with that.
What do you think, Peter?
I think all I can say is, oh, lucky man. I wish I were the same and I could be inoculated with your abilities. I don't think there's anything wrong with feeling like that. I mean, it's a wonderful situation to find yourself in. A lot of people have, or at least some people, have said to me that they feel like that, and you have a bit of a look at them and you think, you're kidding me, you're not telling me the truth, but I believe you implicitly. You've got the ring of truth about your voice, for sure.
Is there a relationship between curiosity and the ability to sort of cope with boredom and move beyond it quickly?
I suspect so, but I think if you're a bit of a victim of anything related to chronic boredom, no amount of curiosity is going to jolt you out of it. You're going to have to look for something that will produce the dopamine boost. So invest some money on a falling currency, for example. It's a good way to do it. Very exciting. You might make some money, you might lose it. But that's not curiosity, is it? It's risk-taking.
Yeah, yeah. We have an email here from Lorinda who writes, "Can you talk about boredom and the urge to create? I have a school-age son who is very often bored and gifted, loves to take risks, and is constantly creating contraptions. Coincidentally or not," Lorinda writes, "he's also been diagnosed with ADD.
He has been diagnosed with ADD.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. It's that he's working to create gadgets does sound like a self-medication almost that he's using. But what I would imagine that encouraging the creativity in a case like this would actually help it a lot. There is some research that I mention in the book done by a person called Katia Rubia that that suggests that people with ADHD are more prone to suffer boredom than others, and that the normal treatment, Ritalin, actually helps because it, in some way or another, smooths out the passing of time, which apparently weighs very heavily on people suffering from ADHD. What sort of creative activities would help? It depends on the child, doesn't it? But you would think that that's one real good way to help, rather than encouraging too much football playing and so on, where risk-taking might come in.
Well, and it does seem natural that if you are sitting around on a Sunday afternoon and there's nothing to do, so many of us decide on a project and we do something that is pretty constructive.
Yes, we do, rather than sitting around and
wallowing,
complaining
yeah.
about it, yes. When you're younger, you don't, do you? You sit with your friends and...
commiserate, yeah.
Yeah, I'll go and buy a six-pack and it gets worse and worse. But yes, the link with creativity is a very strong one, and it's mentioned again and again, and it's often mentioned as a defense for boredom, rather than, say, as a medication, which the email was asking about. Why are bored people often creative? I guess because, in the simplest of ways, they get fed up and dissatisfied with the normal ways of doing things, and they look for a variety or a newer way of doing things. So it must be good if you're a scientist or a painter, you would think. And I imagine it's a very valuable thing in an entrepreneur to get slightly bored and fed up with the same way of doing things. So you're going to rejig your product and you would hope make a better product accordingly.
As a scholar, do you find the writing process both boring and stimulating by turns?
I don't know. It's Dallas, isn't it? So it's definitely my dean can't hear. So if I say that the process of writing is excruciatingly boring, I'm not going to get into strife, am I? So that's the answer. Yes, no, I find writing boring and the process boring. And I think it's probably a good thing. We should feel that. What is rational and logical in sitting in a room on your own for hours upon end trying to spin words? I think the reading is often interesting and the research is interesting. It's great to talk to people about it, but when you have to write it up, it's a form of slow death for me.
Well, the book doesn't feel that way. I will let people know that. It's interesting to read. Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have another Tim on the line, this one from Dallas. Hey, Tim.
Hey there. Great topic as always. So for me, kind of the panacea, if you will, is if you're bored, you're boring. And I've kind of, tried to live that way, particularly since, becoming an adult. And it seems to work almost every single time. Now, not every time and certainly not in every circumstance. But, for me, that really does work.
So it spurs you on, Tim, to action, to do something else when you feel bored.
That's exactly right. And it is all about action for me. And which kind of leads to what my question is, which is that is there and has there been a shift, an increase in what the guest might perceive as boredom in society because of the way that our society has changed with regard to technology? We don't have to do, quote unquote, as much. And so it gives us more time to sit and contemplate or not have anything to do, if you will.
Peter?
Yes, it's something that comes up a lot and quite rightly. A really simple way, not quite what you're saying, but pretty much the same sort of thing, is you're stuck in a queue or stuck in your car. You shouldn't be doing it, perhaps, but you pull out your smartphone and begin to play Scrabble. We have less opportunity for boredom in a sense, don't we? Because there's so many things we can do in what were traditionally fairly dull circumstances. Many people argue that as a result, we don't get bored as much. But then maybe the downside to that is we have more of a hair trigger for boredom because we have so many gadgets to stop us being bored. And iPhones particularly go flat with alarming regularity, don't they? So what do you do then? You're stuck in the queue and you can't play Scrabble.
You know, it has occurred to me that we, you know, with all the devices and things we have available to us 24/7 so that we don't have to experience boredom, there is a little bit less pure thinking time, which may not always be fun, but often does sort of yield important results.
Yes, again, it's that's the downside, isn't it, that a lot of people say we have much less time to think with all of these sorts of things. It seems on the face of it to be true, doesn't it, that we're occupied so much with these things. But I would say to that maybe we should think a little bit harder about all the sorts of things that we do. For example, if you're a kid, you're in school and you've been told to turn your phone off. If you're an older person and you're living in a retirement complex or often often ones which you could say justifiably are worse, you're probably not going to be using one either. And so there's going to be tracts of boredom at either end of a lifetime, I think, that's to say in school and in the later end of retirement. And for most of us, work can be pretty boring. You can't necessarily text or play Scrabble when you're doing your work tasks, and they're repetitive and dull. So it seems like we have a much less opportunity to become bored, but I think many of the things that we have to do at various portions of our life leave us open to boredom just as much as they did for our parents and our grandparents.
Well, and tolerance for boredom is required, at least some level of boredom is required for us to succeed in life in some ways.
Yes, I think so. There was an Englishman talking about there should be tedium studies.
Who would take that class?
Yes. It comes up periodically, doesn't it? One of the things you do with school kids is you habituate them to boredom. Get used to it, son. You're going to have a lifetime of it when you get a job. And that's not as silly as it sounds. And part of our socializing skill is learning coping strategies. For example, the saying, what Tim said, that I think of myself as boring and it jolts me out of it. So he's learned to cope.
Peter Tuohy is my guest. He's professor of classics at the University of Calgary. His new book is called Boredom, A Lively History. You can join us on the line at 1-800-933-5372 or at think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Peter Tuohy is my guest. He's written a new book called Boredom, A Lively History, and he earns his living as professor of classics in the Department of Greek and Roman Studies at the University of Calgary. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Peter, I'm going to throw this out there. It's entirely my unscientific observation, but it does seem that the tendency to be bored, at least occasionally, does provide us with a kind of social sensitivity so that we're perhaps more aware that we might be boring other people if we have had the experience often of being bored by others.
I think so, yes. So boredom sensitizes us to even empathizes us a little bit. I think it's true. I hope it's true. That it's had some value for me in my life. That yes, I'm sure of that. Perhaps this is going to link too with this notion that boredom gives you this empty time, as it were, in where you can step back and get a greater sense of yourself. Not so much as a rounded individual, but what you are, what you value, what you do, and so on. So it increases individuality, I think, in people in a good sort of a way, one that isn't possible, a sense of yourself that's not possible if you're constantly too busy.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me as well that people, there are different things that bore different people. You're a professor of Greek and Roman studies. That lights some people on fire. Other people would much rather talk about contemporary literature or mathematics or biochemistry. We're not bored by the same things.
No, I think we're certainly not. It's the definition has got to work in some sort of a way that we'll pick up the various ways of experiencing. It's what's predictable to you is not necessarily predictable to me, and that's going to be background, ability, and so on. Mm-hmm. If you're bad at mathematics, mathematical talk is going to be predictable in a sense, isn't it?
Yeah.
Predictably dull. So I guess there's no way of getting around something like that. The only constant in what's not boring is if you're a sufferer of chronic boredom, isn't it?
Mm.
But it's a fairly typical set of risk-taking behaviors.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Alini in Euless. Hi, Alini.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Okay. Well, I'm originally from Brazil, and this subject of boredom comes up a lot in my marriage. My husband is American, and he gets bored pretty easily, and I don't, because I believe that in Brazil we take more breaks and we enjoy them more. Like we're okay about not doing anything on weekends.
Mm-hmm.
And Americans are always going and they're always doing something. And I think that, my question was if there is anything, also if boredom has anything to do with culture.
What do you know about that, Peter?
I think what you're saying is certainly true, that some cultures, it probably goes this way. Some cultures actively disapprove of boredom more than others. And I think it probably links with their desire to remove activities that are pointless and purposeless from normal life. They're particularly associated with the Reformation, I think, and with the valuation of work that came with the Reformation, and perhaps too with the Enlightenment. So a country that avoided the Reformation to some degree, like Brazil, we could even say Spain and France, are perhaps more okay with this non-work culture. So that may link precisely with what Eleni is saying, at least in terms of her background.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Midge in Dallas. Hello, Midge.
Hi. What would we do if we didn't have Sudoku and crosswords? It would never have been invented without boredom.
I think you'd have to buy a smartphone and play Scrabble.
To me, boredom is just the most wonderful creative cesspool in the world. And if I sit down with my Sudoku and my boredom, I come up immediately with a poem or a song or something.
So it's encouraging creativity in you for sure, isn't it?
Yeah, and what a great creative cesspool. That's a really fantastic term.
I've written it down.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We're speaking with Peter Tuohy, author of the new book, Boredom, A Lively History. Let's go next on the phones to Mark in Wiley. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I heard earlier Professor Tuohy mention the Latin word tedium, and I was wondering if tedium has to do more with a dissatisfaction of the task, whereas the Latin word otium would be leisure in the broad sense. And I noticed in my studies of classics that, not that they compare to yours, but Cicero likes leisure. That's when he writes his letters, he gets lots of stuff done, and it's the opposite of negotium, which is business. Whereas for Catullus, otium is sort of a deadly thing, that, like in Catullus 51, where it destroys cities and ruins kings, and he sees it as a problem. And I'm wondering if Professor Tuohy had any comments on the meaning of otium and its relation to tedium.
Thanks for your call.
Tedium means something like something closer to disgusting when it's in the singular. It only means boredom when it's in the plural, which is an odd sort of thing. So it's got to be TDR. so that if you talk, there's a common English expression, tedium vitae, which is more English than Latin, though they're Latin words, which means the disgust or weariness with life. So that's the sense in Latin and in English for tedium. I guess our tedium, when it's absolutely anglicized, becomes something like boredom, but not in Latin. It's got to be in the plural. And yes, by and large, they did value otium a lot and dislike negotium, that is to say, what negates otium, this sense of leisure. And the reason for it, I think, is because it was a profoundly aristocratic society that handed the business activities not to the most able in society, but to those who were more marginalized. So Catullus is saying something else again, but for Cicero, negotium is not what a gentleman would do. He'd indulge in otium.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. I'm wondering, Peter, if as a lecturer you've given, has this been part of your sort of boredom studies when you look out to see, is the entire room really engaged in what you have to say? Are you losing some in the back of the room? Do you think that makes you more sensitive to this question?
I hope it does. I really hope. And I'm on sabbatical at the minute, and when I come back, boy, they're going to look hard at me, aren't they? Don't you dare bore us. But I think you do become hypersensitized to creating boredom in people, particularly with very large classes. When you see them drifting off, it spooks you a little, I think, and you do try to do things to draw them back. Because it's not offensive, but horrifying that you could be putting people through torture for 50 minutes.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Manohar on the line now. Hi, Manohar.
Hi, this is Manohar. It's a very stimulating topic. I was thinking that having selected this secular form of society and political institutions, we are led to believe from our leaders and leading institutions that all you have to do is just work, pay taxes, and be good, don't get in trouble, and that's okay. Whereas if you consider the spiritual path or religious path, then you have to be more expansive, more helpful, more inquisitive, etc. So those of them which are actually confined to being very, very voluntary, these are compulsory, which are driven by our political institutions. So I think that boredom is basically inculcated as an ingredient into our political process. And because of lack of the touch of spirituality or whatever, so we are never going into those areas where we can be inquisitive and be helpful and so on and so forth. What's your comment on it?
I can see what you're getting at. That is to say, if a legal system is introducing compulsion into the way that we should behave, that is one of your first things, the unavoidability that's linked with boredom, isn't it? And if it's repeated, it's going to become predictable. So yes, over legislation certainly is going to encourage boredom, and you would hope that spirituality, which is something that's chosen and can be something that is avoidable because it's chosen and is less predictable, would be better for people. So that, I guess you're suggesting that something that they could buy into rather than something that they're told they should do, the buying in is the good thing.
It's worth thinking about this idea that a lot of different, very different religious traditions still incorporate an element of religious contemplation or ritual prayer or chanting or meditation, things that to be done properly, you're sort of not supposed to feel any boredom while you're engaging in them.
Yes, I think once you learn how to do them, I would imagine that learning how to do them must be could be excruciatingly boring,
yeah.
Couldn't it?
Yeah. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Carly in Carrollton. Hello, Carly.
Hi, my name is Chloe, and I have a question. During your research, have you ever attempted to relate boredom and IQ together?
It's a touchy one, isn't it? Because you're easily moving into the grounds of the of privilege, and people with high IQs don't get so much bored, do they or don't they? What do you think on that one?
What's your opinion, Carly? Do you think people? Oh, we just lost her on the phone.
I don't think you could go either way. Really, I suspect that that highly intelligent people get bored a lot, and I cite in defence of that as Warren Buffett really saying, "We don't do a lot here in Omaha. We sit around and wait for a break, and then it's all busy for a little while." So I think that often for people like that who are very intelligent, there's vast tracts of boring activity, and perhaps, to people who have lower IQs get more bored? Perhaps not. Perhaps they're more satisfied with simpler things. So you could see it going either way, couldn't you, on something like that?
So if there is some potential creative value to the experience of boredom, is it worth deliberately seeking out, or will we have enough of it naturally that we don't need to add to it?
Well, maybe the way to say it is we probably shouldn't shy away from it.
Uh-huh.
That if it's coming, maybe let it come and see where it goes. There's the famous lines from Joseph Brodsky: when hit by boredom, go for it. Let yourself be crushed by it. Submerge, hit rock bottom. And there is something to be said for it. In your greatest moments of despair, you usually get your best ideas, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think we should be saying, what can I do that's really boring today so that I'll win the Nobel Prize? Rather, if it's coming, go with it a little bit.
Yeah, find a way to tolerate it for a while.
Yes, see what happens.
So one of your remedies when you simply can't stand being bored anymore is exercise.
So it's said that it's a remedy. Now, I wouldn't want to put myself in a dreadful position. but yes, aerobic exercise seems to be fairly good. Monotony shrinks the brain, it's often said, and that is to say, boredom itself, whereas aerobic exercise is actually good for this neurogenesis, this regrowth of brain cells. So it seems logical then that aerobic exercise would actually help. It's bad news. We're being told to exercise for our hearts, for every other portion of us, and now it's to avoid boredom. So I'm the bringer of bad news,
I
think.
We're running out of excuses, certainly.
Yes, indeed.
Do you think our ancestors would be shocked to find out that in this fast-moving modern world where we have entertainments available to us around the clock, that we still experience this emotion that they were so familiar with?
I don't think they'd be surprised at all, because that have asked the question, you know, do your children go to school? And we'd have said yes. And children get bored at school. And what do you do with your old people? Do they ever get bored? And they'd say, ours do. I'll bet yours do too.
Hmm.
So I think those really key ones, they're still with us.
Peter Tuohy is professor of classics in the Department of Greek and Roman Studies at the University of Calgary. His book is called Boredom, A Lively History. Peter, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris, for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.